Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hey, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. It is always a wonderful pleasure to meet you here at Faith Radio on Connecting Faith. You can check out my ministry website, which is reconnectwithcarmen.com. And what we're trying to do here every day on Connecting Faith is reconnect the eternal with the everyday in ways that honor Jesus. We are seeking to take literally the headline news and apply the mind of Christ and prepare ourselves to enter into the conversations of our day in ways that honor Jesus. So I'm actually bringing you a headline from 49 minutes ago. And so it began, this is a conversation that began yesterday when a former writer for Sesame Street identified Bert and Ernie as a loving couple. The Sesame Street Workshop then posted a statement denying that Bert and Ernie's relationship was anything other than good friends. And since then, others in the on the creative team and those involved with Sesame Street have weighed in on whether or not Bert and Ernie are gay. I know, brace yourselves. We're talking here about puppets. And let me just keep us very mindful of that as we continue this conversation. So this is going to be a conversation about puppets. It's going to be a conversation about puppeteering. It's also going to be a conversation about culture. It's going to be a conversation about whether or not it even matters what someone's sexual orientation is in terms of who they are and who they were created to be. So it does. It's a conversation that I think is worth entering into because we can do so in a conversation about education and about preschoolers and about the power of visual media and how television and television-like products are used to educate children and who writes for those and on and on and on. So let me start off by saying this. Bert and Ernie are puppets. Bert and Ernie are characters on Sesame Street, on the Sesame Street Workshop. Puppets do what human beings make them do. Puppets may appear to say something, but puppets actually only say that which people put in their mouths. Puppets only move in whatever way human beings make them move. So when Sesame Street Workshop was forced to publicly deny that two of its characters, Bert and Ernie, are not gay, but good friends, you might find yourself furrowing your brow because, you know, it's a show for preschoolers. So why are we even at some level having this conversation? But there's a writer involved here, and the writer is the one who declared in an interview with Queerty. Queerty is, as you might suspect, a publication related to those who identify as queer or gender fluid or at least gender non-binary. And so his name is Mark Saltzman. Mark Saltzman was a writer for Sesame Street Workshop. And he said this in his interview with Queerty. He said, "I always felt that without a huge agenda, but I always felt that I was writing Bert and Ernie. I always felt that they were gay. I didn't have any other way to conceptualize them." He added that he was already with his now late partner of 20 years, whose name was Arnie. And at the time, Mark Saltzman says that when he started writing for the show in 1984, "I don't think that I knew how else to write them other than as a loving couple." Well, Sesame Street Workshop issued a statement saying, "Oh, no. Bert and Ernie are our characters. Bert and Ernie, are actually properties that belong to Sesame Street Workshop. And Bert and Ernie are good friends." Here is Sesame Street's very public statement yesterday. "As we have always said, Bert and Ernie are best friends. They were created to teach preschoolers that people can be good friends, even with those who are very different from themselves. Even though they are identified as male characters and possess many human traits and characteristics, as, by the way, Sesame Street says most puppets do, they remain puppets. They do not have sexual orientation." Okay. So they go on then. This is a Sesame Street. They go on then to encourage people to look back at the things that the Sesame Street workshop was forced to say in response to a 2013 New Yorker issue that certainly suggested that Bert and Ernie were a gay couple and would be seeking to wed after the Obergefell decision by the Supreme Court of the United States. And so this is a conversation that is cultural. It's a conversation that's relevant, and it's a conversation that you and I can enter into today. And when you do that, let me encourage you to do so in a way that honors the creator of all things, that honors the way people are made uniquely in the image of God, male and female, uniquely called into marital relationships or loving relationships that actually reflect the relationship of Christ with his church revealed to us in Scripture, both in Genesis and then confirmed by Jesus in the Gospels and then referenced in the book of Revelation as well. And so, well, I guess in addition to all the things that the Apostle Paul has to say about marriage and its sanctity and the mystery of it in terms of how it points to a reality that is eternal in heaven. Okay, the other person whose comments I think are relevant here and where I want to settle in for just a minute in this conversation about Bert and Ernie is his name is Frank Oz. And Frank Oz is a puppeteer. Frank Oz was a longtime collaborator of the Muppets creator, Jim Henson. Jim Henson died in 1990. And so Frank Oz's comments as a longtime collaborator of Jim Henson are certainly relevant here. Frank Oz reminds everybody that he created Bert. He goes on to say, look, I created Bert. I know what and who he is. And so remember, we're talking here about a puppet, first of all, and then look at the language of creator and the creator language and how the creator feels very much in a position to say that as the creator, I know what and who he is. There is a design involved here. There is an intentionality in that language. And I think that gives us the opportunity to talk about people as created beings, created image in the image of God on purpose and for a purpose. God actually has a design in mind. And the creator's will actually matters. So Frank Oz, the puppeteer and again, a longtime collaborator of the Muppets creator, Jim Henson, chimed in on this subject. And he says this about Mr. Saltzman's comments. He says, it seems Mr. Mark Saltzman was asked if Bert and Ernie are gay. It's fine that he feels they are. They're not, of course, he said. But why that question? Does it really matter? Why the need to define people as only gay? There's much more to a human being than just straightness or gayness. Now, here again, I feel compelled to remind us that we're talking about puppets. We're not actually talking about people. We're talking about, really wonderful yellow felt and really wonderful orange felt, if you know what Bert and Ernie look like. We're talking about one who wears vertical stripes and one who wears horizontal stripes. We're talking about one who is fairly thin and one who is more rounded in appearance. But we're talking about puppets. And we're talking about puppets who are being assigned human attributes. And so I think this is a conversation that opens up the possibility of you and I engaging the culture, using a conversation that the culture is already having about Bert and Ernie and puppets and Sesame Street. And it gives us an opportunity to use sentences like that from Mr. Oz about it's, you know, it means much more to be a human being than the gayness or straightness, to actually say, well, what do you think it does mean to be a human being? What does it mean to be human? And where do you get that idea? And if you get the idea that you are a created being, then the will of the creator matters. And God has been gracious to reveal as the creator that we're fearfully and wonderfully made, that he conceived of us before the foundations of the earth, that he knit us together in our mother's wombs, that we're created on purpose and for a purpose, that he's actually decided in advance the good works that we should be about doing, that we are created in the literal image of God as moral beings in and for relationship. And yes, we are relational. And how we relate to God and how we relate to ourselves and therefore how we then in turn relate to other people actually does matter. And it's intended to be reflective of the kingdom of heaven and the principles of the kingdom of heaven. And sexuality is a part of that, but way down the list in terms of how we're actually defined by the Creator. And we're called to be holy. That would be another part of what it means to be human in terms of the way God sees us and God and God's desire for us. So I feel like there's just a lot, there are a lot of conversations that you and I can enter into today in this Bert and Ernie Sesame Street conversation. One of the people who is out there in the world every single day equipping pastors and Christian leaders and congregations in these areas of relational and sexual brokenness and recovery is Gary Ingram. Gary is the executive director of the Love and Truth Network. And next up on Connecting Faith, he's going to join me to talk about a range of topics that we deal with every single day in the culture related to just our relationships and sexuality. So I'm looking forward to a conversation coming up next with Gary Ingram. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Hey friends, you're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. I am joined in conversation now by Gary Ingram. Gary is the executive director of the Love and Truth Network, and he's also the director of Transforming Congregations. So what Gary does every single day is talks with pastors and Christian leaders about issues related to relationships and sexuality and how we as Christians can engage these subject matter areas and walk with those who are confused and broken and seeking redemption. And so, Gary, welcome back to Connecting Faith.
Thank you very much, Carmen. You said that incredibly well.
That's well, exactly thank you. I've been practicing. So let's start with this. I would love for you to simply share with people like the range and scope of issues that Christians in the culture and churches specifically are dealing with when we're talking about relationships and sexuality.
Well, I'd say, first of all, what we're dealing with is a piling up, where sexuality has not been addressed well in the church for years and decades, and we're experiencing now everything from heterosexual sexual brokenness and massive amounts, if you look at statistics, of pornography addiction, heterosexual, both fornication as well as adultery within the church, but particularly pornography addiction, and then also the wide range of LGBTQ issues within the church, everything from pro-gay theology, where churches are saying that, you know, that God is totally cool with monogamous gay relationships, as well as those that really don't, they believe an orthodox perspective about human sexuality, but they don't know what to do about it, and they're not even equipping those in their church that are dealing with the heterosexual areas of brokenness.
Okay, so let's say there's people listening right now and they say, hey, I realize that those are all issues and I would love to be equipped and I would love for my church to be equipped. Give us a website that they can go to, that they can write down and they can visit to find some resources.
Sure. So our main website is loveandtruthnetwork.com. And then also you mentioned that I'm also the director for Transforming Congregations. That ministry is the same essentially as Love and Truth Network, but it's focused within the United Methodist Church. And there are all kinds of issues around these, the matters of human sexuality in that denomination right now. And that would be transformingcongregations.org. Either one of those websites, people could reach out to me from those and begin the conversation on how we can come alongside of them and help. And our desire isn't to swoop in and do a conference or just preach on a Sunday morning. I do all that kind of thing. But really it's to walk alongside over the long haul in what we desire to see, which is a shift in environment, a shift in culture within the body of Christ around the issues of transparency and openness with our struggles.
Okay, so again, friends, I'm talking with Gary Ingram. He is Executive Director of the Love and Truth Network. We're going to direct you to loveandtruthnetwork.com for resources related to the conversation that we're having today. So Gary, I'm gonna try to cover three recent stories in the headlines, so you and I can sort of demonstrate how Christians can engage on issues that are, you know, front and center in the culture. So recently, Brown University repressed some research that was indicating that there's a social contagion among young women in America seeking hormone therapy and gender reassignment surgery. What are you hearing about that?
Well, of course, I've read those same headlines and heard that same news from sources that I commonly refer to. And, it's a tragic thing. It really underscores what we've known for a long time, which is science is taking a backseat, and research, solid research, is taking a backseat to political correctness and to the whole matter of identity politics, really. And so it's striking. It's profoundly sad because ultimately the people that are losing are those that are confused and those that are beginning to wonder about their identity, especially at younger and younger ages, and kids being allowed. I was just looking, in most states, kids still need parental consent to even get their ears pierced, under the age of 18. And yet we're beginning in schools and other places to really build in this idea of being open to identity, but it really it breeds a lot of confusion around who in the world I am. Kids have always wrestled. We've always wondered. It's part of our childhood development. Who am I? Where do I belong? What is my purpose in life? And these days now, it never involved, am I a boy or am I a girl? But now these days, that's one of the primary questions, and it really has removed all of the good and healthy boundaries in which we grow up structurally to become solid men or women.
Okay, you just raised a really interesting point that maybe I have been missing out on this portion of the conversation, but you're right. Like, you still have to have parental permission to get your ears pierced. I'm pretty sure that in a lot of states, there's an age in terms of getting tattoos as well.
Yes.
And so now we're talking about schools intervening and assisting students who are identifying with something other than their biological gender, and parents actually being kept out of those conversations. It's really extraordinary. So that's a conversation for which Christians need to be equipped. How about this one? I read last week that New York City is joining Oregon, California, Washington, and New Jersey in allowing people to change what's called the gender marker, either the male or female designation on their birth certificate, to a neutral X. How do we respond to that?
Well, I think that when it comes to the matter of male and female, what I would say from a biblical perspective for Christians is in Genesis 1:26 and 27, where God made us in his image, male and female, he put distinctive aspects of who he is within women that are of equal value to men. That's been an issue in the past. We don't have time for all that. But of absolutely equal value to men, and a different aspect of his image into men of equal value to women. But they're meant to actually live out and express the image of God differently on the earth. And so when we get confused about not just who we are as men and women, but maybe I'm neither, or I'm some wide variety. I'd read an article even a number of years ago that said that there's actually thousands of genders. And the tragedy really is we begin to lose what it means to be made in the image of God through all of this confusion. So, never mind all of the most basic when it comes to medical needs and it comes to being diagnosed and being properly treated. If we're not going clearly we cannot medically treat a man as a woman and a woman as a man in all instances and situations, or in many instances and situations. So to live in this idea of that we can switch genders or we can be no gender, even from a medical scientific perspective, is utterly ridiculous. And I would also say I understand that there are many people who support these ideas out of the best of motivations. But if you follow this rabbit down the hole very far at all, you realize this is an absolute travesty and a loss for the person who's struggling.
So that reference to a rabbit going down the hole, I think we talk about Alice in Wonderland and the reality of Oz-like spaces today, and where things are literally turned upside down and inside out, and right is wrong and wrong is right, and we begin to understand what Lewis Carroll was actually talking about in ways that I think we never understood before. All right, one more. Maybe we've got time to cover one more thing. And again, friends, my conversation partner is Gary Ingram. You can find him at loveandtruthnetwork.com. You can also find him on Twitter at Gary with two R's and then the word Marks, M-A-R-X. Gary Marks is his Twitter handle. Okay, so Gary, I got an email from a listener. This has been a couple of weeks back, maybe as much as a month back. And they had just dropped off their daughter, a freshman in college. And apparently she had been assigned to a dorm where my listener described she described it as a co-ed dorm with co-ed bathrooms. Now, you and I both know that means that young woman is now living in what the university recognizes as a gender-inclusive housing. Tell people what gender-inclusive housing is, and then maybe equip us for, how do we even begin to engage that conversation, not only with our kids, but with parents who maybe don't even know?
Well, so this idea of gender-inclusive housing is certainly, it's not just, again, a co-ed, as you're saying. It really is, it's part of the ideology of gender can be anything that you want it to be. And being born a biological male or female has nothing to do with the gender reality of a person. I would really clearly disagree with that. But that's the kind of thing that young people now are kind of being thrown into in schools. And what that really prompts, the response that prompts for me is actually parents that have 3- and 4-year-old children or children on the way. This is really a conversation that needs to begin with parents all the way back there to begin to develop in their children a really good sense in the culture that we live in. What does it mean to be born and to be chosen by God to be a boy or a girl, to become a man or a woman? And so this idea of layer upon layer of conversation, parents can no longer afford, not that it was ever a good idea, to put off the conversation. It's not about a conversation. It's about a very long conversation that we're having with our kids and building in not just what is wrong. That's one of the things that the church gets nailed for, I think, accurately oftentimes, is not just what's wrong with the brokenness in culture and things like that in our own lives, but what's the glory of God for us as male and female, and to begin to sow those things into our kids so that when we drop them off in an environment like that, they have a really solid sense of who they are and how to become disciple makers and evangelists in the right sense of the word, in the right way, within their own environments.
Oh, I just love that. All right, friends, that's Gary Ingram. You can find him at loveandtruthnetwork.com. Next up, I'm going to be talking with J. Warner Wallace. You know him as the detective who wrote Cold Case Christianity. We're going to talk today about the forensic faith of kids. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Hey, friends, you're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. I am so excited to be joined today by J. Warner Wallace. He is a family favorite in our household. You can follow him on Twitter at J. Warner Wallace. You can check out what he's doing at coldcasechristianity.com. And today we're going to talk about forensic faith for kids. J. Warner, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Well, thanks for having me. This is going to be great fun.
This is a little bit of like a fan. There's a little bit of a fan thing going on now, so I'm just letting you know. There's some palm waving. There's some palm waving at my house for you. So for those who don't know, Jay Warner
is it your daughter who's using the book?
She loves it. So she's actually a little bit older than the book is written for. It's like really geared toward kids who are 8 to 12. She's a little bit older than that. But she loves solving mysteries. She loves engaging with the material. And you have designed this book forensic faith for kids in such a way that it is genuinely engaging. And she's already a kid who like has this kind of like well thought out reasonableness to her faith. But what you're equipping her to do is actually share that with other people in a way that's really fun. And you're helping her develop what you describe in here as a forensic faith. So why don't we just tell people what that is? What is a forensic faith?
So the word forensis is a Latin word that basically means to do in public. So this idea is, could you make a case? Do you have enough good reasons, good evidence to be able to make a case for what you believe publicly? And is this really the definition of faith that is offered in Scripture? Because if you look at it, Jesus never says, hey, just believe me. He always says, if you don't believe what I'm telling you, believe on the testimony of John the Baptist, believe on the evidence of these miracles I'm working. He always points to other things. He starts off by providing evidence to support his claims. And even when John the Baptist has got problems and not quite sure, and he sends his disciples to Jesus, and they say, hey, John sent us and he wants to know, are you the one? Could you imagine if that was your cousin who baptized you, who's known all along? If that's the guy who's now questioning you, you could say a lot of things in response to his disciples. But instead of saying anything, Jesus does three miracles in front of John's disciples. He says, go back and tell John what you just saw. That is a very evidential. He's making a case in public, publicly, for what it is he wants his hearers to accept as true, even though it may seem outlandish, it may seem like I wish I had some more evidence for this, but you've got enough evidence to move on this. And that's what we want our kids to see, is that, hey, this is not your parents asking you to take a blind leap like we did. It's that this is the most reasonable inference from evidence, in spite of the fact that you're going to have unanswered questions. That's the truth. That's the case for everyone. Every criminal trial I ever worked, there were unanswered questions. That's the kind of stuff we're talking about in these kids' books. But we're doing it in the context of a mystery that each reader has to unwrap. And it's not related to Christianity. In Forensic Faith for Kids, it's related to my dog, Bailey, who's a corgi. I kind of put her in the book, and that's the kind of the mystery involves this dog and how do we find where this dog came from. But you're going to learn about your faith along the way and what faith really means along the way.
All right, it's really fun. It's Forensic Faith for Kids. It actually follows the same chapter sequence as the book Forensic Faith. And so let's encourage people also, Jay Warner, this is actually something that adults can do with kids, that parents can do with kids, or grandparents can do with kids, or small group leaders can do with kids, because you've got the adult version of this in Forensic Faith, and then you've got this kid's version, which follows the same chapter sequence. So tell me what your feedback has been from folks who have done that together.
Well, this is the challenge. Honestly, this is the big challenge. The big challenge has been that do we continue to watch the number of young people walk away from the church in their teens and 20s like we have for the last 15, 20 years? It's a huge number of people who are walking away. Or are we willing to rethink the way we've been living our faith in front of our kids so that they will catch it, not as a matter of opinion? Like, this is my personal preference for how we should live, or this is my personal preference related to all the ways that we think about God. Now, what if this is the objective truth about who God is? We want our kids to see it that way, but it means that we're going to have to start to live it that way. And what I mean by that is most young people who walk away from the church, they ask questions, and they tell us afterwards in polls what the questions are that they're asking. And they're asking questions like, hey, why should I believe this when evolution explains it a different way? And they've got all kinds of questions about the problem of evil, questions about how science and faith work together. These are all questions that most of us as parents are hoping our kids will never ask, because we're not ready to answer it. And we have to become different in our approach. And look, it's a little bit more of an ask, right? I mean, it used to be I could just say, well, I don't need any good reasons to believe this. I just believe it's true, and that's been fine for me for 30 years. Well, guess what? It's probably not fine for your kids. They want not just the what is true, tell me what you believe, Mom. They want to know, well, why is that true? Why would you believe that, given all the other alternatives? And don't think for a second your kids don't have access to the alternatives. We're in the information age. And it used to be that, you know, 85% of Christians became Christians by the age of 18. That right now is around 13, which means the age of skepticism is dropping. And why is that dropping? Because you don't have to wait for college to encounter a skeptic. They're at the end of your arm in that glowing rectangle called a phone. They're all out there talking to our kids. We now have to be in a position where we can offer good answers, because typically they'll tell us the reason why they leave is because there were no good answers. Well, there are good answers. We just don't happen to know them.
Mm. All right, friends, I know you're now thinking that you want a copy. And so you can either text or call us at 877-933-2484. We've got a handful of copies to give away. So you are entering a drawing for the book, because I know there will be more people who want it than copies that we have. But text or call us at 877-933-2484. You can always email me, Carmen@myfaithradio.com. You can check it out at coldcasechristianity.com. You'll see there's lots of options, but one of them is Forensic Faith for Kids. So can we take a step back and tell people why we would be listening to you talking with us about these things? Share with people your journey to faith and then your expertise in this field and why you write this way.
Well, so I was not raised in a Christian environment. Didn't really have anybody. I had no close friends of our family that were Christians who shared the gospel or even what Christianity was. But my wife, who I met when I was a teenager, when she was kind of raised in a culturally Catholic background. So when we had our own kids, she was like, "Well, should we like raise our kids in the church?" And I thought she meant the Catholic Church. Well, it didn't matter to me. I was happy to go as a non-believer. My dad would be happy to go to church as an atheist. He still is. And he'd be happy to go because he believes that Christianity offers a useful delusion. But when I first stepped into that church, I was only interested in pleasing my wife. And if she wants to raise kids with a certain moral grounding, that's fine. I mean, it serves a purpose, like my dad would say. I was happy to go. But I got there, and the pastor was clever enough to pitch Jesus as a really smart ancient sage. He said a lot of other things too, of course, but that's the thing that stuck with me. And so I bought a Bible just to see what Jesus had to say. And as I started working through it, I work cold case homicides, and these are events in the distant past for which we have no living eyewitnesses. If you had a witness back in the day, it would have got solved back in the day. The reason why it's cold is because it was lame to begin with. So I've got no living eyewitnesses. I've got reports. Can I trust these reports, what they're telling me? A lot of it is a very similar skill set to looking through the Gospels. And I just applied the aspects of eyewitness reliability to the Gospels, and I ended up in a position where I had to do something with this guy who rose out of the grave. And that's where I began the whole – so it took me 6 months to even begin the journey toward hearing the Gospel message, because I wasn't sure that Jesus either really lived or lived as recorded in the Gospels or did the things recorded in the Gospels. And I thought that everyone who became a Christian did all this stuff that I did. You know, we test it. We know how to test eyewitnesses. But turns out nobody who actually became a Christian that way. Instead, a lot of us will say that the chief reason why we are Christians, this is the most popular answer I get nationally, is that we were raised in the church. That is the most popular answer you get. Why are you a Christian? It's not because I went to examine the evidence and I discovered it was true evidentially. It's that I happen to be raised this way. Or they'll say, I've had an experience that for me demonstrated that Christianity was true. I had a prayer answered or a miracle I saw. Well, trust me, family, half brothers and sisters who were raised LDS, okay, Mormon. And if you ask them, why are you a Mormon, they'll give you the exact same two reasons. Buddhists will give you the exact same. Muslims will give you the exact same two reasons. I was raised this way is the most popular answer why anyone says they were raised any particular way. Doesn't mean it's true, though. And we would say, hey, you need to kind of look at this more carefully. Well, so do we. Because if that's our chief answer, we're not answering in a way, by the way, your kids want more than you ought, just believe me, you've been raised this way. That is not going to get it done for most of our kids. I think your daughter probably is wired that way similarly, wants to know, is this really true? Well, I think it's time for us to be able to at least answer that question. Now, look, Carmen, you and I both know that they may say this is the reason why I don't believe, but really there's something else that's wagging the dog, right? There's some other desire to do something they shouldn't do. There's some hidden sin. There's some volitional resistance. Fine. What I want to be able to do, though, let's take away the excuses they're offering. Let's at least take away, let's answer the objections, and then we can get to the root issues if the objections aren't the root issues. But a lot of times the objections are the root issues. We have to do a better job of being able to answer their questions.
All right, friends, this is the voice you're hearing is J. Warner Wallace. And we're talking about the book Forensic Faith for Kids. But we're also then, sort of going back through the layers of this conversation. So we're talking about Forensic Faith, which is the book for adults that is, I would describe as a complement to Forensic Faith for Kids. And then we're going back another layer to a book called Cold Case Christianity, where J. Warner actually lays out the 10 principles that that we need to learn in order to apply cold case sort of detective work to the Gospels, and then a four-step template to actually evaluate the claims that are made in the Scriptures in relationship to who Jesus is and specifically to his resurrection. So if you love Lee Strobel, you love the case for Christ, you love apologetics, you love the conversations that we have with folks like Jonathan Morrow at Impact 360 and the Rashi O'Christy people and John Stone Street, if you resonate with those conversations and you've been looking for a resource that is really well designed to engage the questions and at the appropriate level for kids who are 8 to 12 years old, this is your book. Today's your day. The book is Forensic Faith for Kids. The website is coldchristianity.com. You can call or text me at 877-933-2484 if you'd like to enter a drawing for the book, or you can always email me, carmen@myfaithradio.com. You can find Jay Warner on Twitter at Jay Warner Wallace. Jay Warner, I'm interested to know when you think about where we are at this cultural moment, if there's one question that you get more often than not. And so this could be a question from any, you know, age level person and anybody out there. But what's the question you hear most often that goes unanswered?
Well, I think most a big category of objections falls into what we call the problem of evil, right? This idea that there's an all-powerful, all-loving God. Then why would he allow something to happen to my loved one? I get this a lot just as an investigator, right? Because you forget about Christianity. They'll say, look, how can this happen to my daughter? If I can figure that out, I can solve the case. Well, okay, same thing is true when you talk about God. If God's all-powerful, then doesn't he have the power to stop it? Does he not care to stop it? Then why are we calling him all-loving? So if he's all-powerful and all-loving, why wouldn't he stop this thing from happening to me, or stop this thing that I've seen in the world, or all the kinds of evil I've seen in the world? Some aspect of the problem of evil has to be addressed. And that's why we wrote a book called God's Crime Scene, in which we talk about evil. And we actually wrote a kids' version, God's Crime Scene for Kids, because we really wanted kids to be able to unpack why it is God would allow any particular act of evil to occur to themselves or to a family member or anything they see in the culture. But I think that is a category. Look, you know, you said something a minute ago that was really striking. If you're interested, you're a Christian out there, and you're interested in the work of Lee, who's a good friend of mine, John Stone Street, who we work together at Colson Center. These are things – or Jonathan Morrow, I've served at Impact 360. So these are friends of mine. But tell you what, forget about those people and forget about my resources. If you just have young Christians in your family and you give a lick about whether they stay Christian, it's time for us to become interested in things that maybe before we weren't interested in. Because that's the problem as I see it, right? The problem as I see it is that we can be, as a group, some of the most unreasonable and unthinking. I hate to say it that way, but for the most part, we've been convinced for whatever reason that true faith is utterly independent of any facts that we could determine, of any evidence, I mean, that believing absolutely blindly. Didn't Thomas come, and didn't Jesus say to Thomas that blessed are those who did not see yet believed? Yeah, but the very next line, it says he continued to give evidence to the disciples. Jesus is either a walking contradiction, or we have to reinterpret what he means by that. What he meant by that was that, Thomas, you're the eyewitness whose testimony will convince those who never saw me that they are now going to believe something that they didn't see themselves, but they're going to trust your eyewitness testimony going forward. And that's what we do, right? We have to point people back to the eyewitnesses of the resurrection and show them why that testimony is reliable, why that testimony, we can test it, and we come away determining, hey, I should believe it, because this is what we do in every criminal trial. The jurors are not going to get to see the crime occur again, but they're going to have to decide if they trust the eyewitnesses who did see the crime. And that's what we're doing here, too. And that Jesus is saying, yeah, blessed are those who, on the basis of your testimony, Thomas, and having never seen it for themselves, will trust you and believe that this is true. And that's how Christianity has grown historically. Look at the book of Acts. The only way the disciples shared their testimony or shared the evidence for Christianity or shared the gospel in the book of Acts was that they said, we were eyewitnesses. That was a criteria. I mean, think about it. Matthias was replaced Judas on the basis of that he, in Acts 1, saw Jesus from the baptism to the resurrection. He was an eyewitness. And that's what qualified him. You'll notice they don't say anything else about his qualifications. The only qualifications they list is he happened to see it all. That's because eyewitnesses, that's called direct evidence, by the way, has been at the root of Christianity from the very beginning. And that's what we need to return to so that our kids, and so that means whatever you're reading, if it's not helping you to make the case to your own kids, we're in a season now, if you've got kids, remember when you have small kids, I don't get to go to the restaurant that I want to go to. I don't get to go on vacation that I want to go on. I don't get to go to the movie that I want to see. We make all of those choices during that season in the best interest of our kids. Well, now whatever you're reading, it's time to put this in the best interest of your kids, because if you want them to actually believe the truth, we're going to have to work for it.
All right, friends. I know you appreciate everything that Jay Warner Wallace is saying. This book, Forensic Faith for Kids, actually helps kids develop what we would describe as good investigative skills in order that they can navigate the tough questions about faith and that they'll be equipped to actually share what they've learned with others. So Jay Warner wrote this book with his wife, Susie. We'd love for you to check it out. It's Forensic Faith for Kids. We do have some copies. I know we've had lots of calls, but we'd be happy to enter you into the drawing as well. The number you can text or call is 877-933-2484. Jay Warner, thank you so much for joining us today on Connecting Faith.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate you.
Hey, friends, you're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. We'll be right back, and I'll make the connecting point. Hey, friends, you are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. It's time in the program to make the connecting point. So sometimes there's a headline that I simply find irresistible. And so this is going to indicate to you what can Carmen not resist when she reads it. And so the city council in Berkeley, California, now leads Berkeley to be the first city in the nation to declare Green Monday, requiring vegan-only food to be served at anything, basically, that the city is involved in. They're supposed to have these at city meetings and events at least once a week, preferably on Monday, so that they can sort of establish this Green Monday movement. So they're saying, hey, we're not asking people to give up meat. We're asking people to think about what they do every day in order that, with the goal. Now, here's the goal. The goal is to reduce our meat consumption. So clearly there's a goal. So the resolution calls for a public campaign of information, which means they're going to use government funds to talk about the environmental impacts of meat and meat production. They're going to talk about climate change. They're going to talk about animal husbandry. The list is pretty long. They're going to talk about pollution. The campaign is going to work in conjunction with an organization called Green Monday US, which is a group encouraging plant-based food choices. With the goal of slowing down climate change. So, obviously, there's some residents in Berkeley who are supportive, others who are not supportive, even some vegans saying this is not really the role of government and this is not really the appropriate use of tax dollars. They're saying, hey, big government should not be involved in mandating what people should or should not eat. And then this person goes on to say, I think it's great, you know, to try to raise people's awareness about food. But and where it comes from and what resources are doing in terms of our planet. But I still don't think that the government should be telling people when they can eat what they can eat. And so I got to thinking, has there ever been a time in history when the government has said to people based on, frankly, religion? Because there's no other way to view this other than to say we've sort of reached the stage of the game where veganism has become kind of a religion. And it's a religion that has sort of come alongside things. Climate change is one of those. Animal sort of rights is one of those. And I am not here in any way, shape, or form to denigrate people who are vegans. I'm here to say I'm not sure that the government should be in the business of promoting any one particular religion. And so if that's what we're talking about here, and we're talking about particularly tax dollars being used to advocate for this in a particular way, then, you know, I got to be one of those people that says, I don't think that's appropriate. So when I survey human history and I say to myself, this didn't take me very long, by the way, this momentary survey of human history to think about when and where were there times and places where governments told people what they could eat and when they could eat it. And immediately what leapt to my mind is fish on Fridays. If you grew up in America and went to public schools like I did, fish was served on Friday. Does anybody know why? Like, is anybody like up to speed on the whole fish on Friday thing? And there's some of you saying right now, oh, I'm up to speed on fish on Fridays. I know why. There was a pope who wanted to help the economy in some particular way. This is sort of the myth behind fish on Fridays. It was actually taught for a period of time. It's sort of the going explanation of why people eat fish on Fridays, specifically Catholics. So if you're Catholic and you're listening, I would love to know your answer to the question of why you eat fish on Fridays, short of me telling you. Like, you know, text me now at 877-933-2484. Email me, Carmen@myfaithradio.com. Tell me why, if you're a Catholic, you eat fish on Fridays. If you're not a Catholic, tell me why you eat fish on Fridays. Like, are you a fish on Friday person? If so, why? What compels you to do that? A long, long time ago in a place far, far away, there were a lot of people who grew up thinking that fish on Fridays was just simply the fact of things, and that that Catholics around the world were eating fish on Fridays as a part of a religious observance. That's the way the story goes. That is, in fact, not true. So there's this myth out there that there was a powerful medieval pope who made a secret pact to prop up the fishing industry with the goal of actually altering global economies, and couched it in terms of a religious observance. Okay, well, that's in fact not true. So if you search the Vatican archives, now this is according to Brian Fagan, who's a professor of archaeology at the University of California in Santa Barbara and wrote a book called Fish on Friday, which, of course, I had to scan pretty quickly. Since I only got this news about Berkeley yesterday in terms of we're going to have Green Mondays and we're all going to act like vegans on that day. So we're going to all act like Catholics on Friday. And if so, why? Like, why fish on Fridays? So I love it that there's people out there who have literally like spent their lives researching stuff like this. And Brian Fagan is one of those, professor at UC Santa Barbara, wrote a book, Fish on Friday, exploring the impact of the practice of fish on Fridays in Western culture. You can imagine that if you could influence the entire public school system of the United States of America to only serve fish on Friday and not some other meat, you could dramatically influence both the fishing industry or the growth of that market and the chicken and beef and every other variety of protein item market. So the real economic story behind fish on Fridays turns out to be at least partially theological, partially economic, and maybe mostly about King Henry VIII. So because I love stories of intrigue like this, I will just tell you that a lot of us eat fish on Fridays, or we started eating fish on Fridays as Christians, because that was the trend in the Middle East. But then eventually we get around to Henry the Eighth, and you might remember a little situation where he wanted to marry somebody that he was already married, and so the whole country became Protestant or now Anglican, and in that he didn't want anybody doing what the Pope had ever said anybody should do, and the Pope had at one point said people should eat fish on Friday, and so he said no, we're not doing that anymore, and if you do, then you're a Papist, and that's going to probably cost you your head, and so everybody in Britain, or in what we know as Great Britain in Anglicanism, started eating meat. And so that's actually how the trend became quote unquote Catholic instead of Protestant, because Protestants started eating meat under the guise of, hey, we're not going to let anybody tell us what to eat or when to eat it. So there's a fish tale. There's a real history tied to sacrifice, and there are real economic impacts. And so when we have the conversations in the culture about whether or not we're going to eat like vegans, you can have the whole conversation about whether or not we're going to eat like Catholics. And then you can talk about religion and whether or not veganism is the new religion of the 21st century. Okay, friends, or maybe it's climate change. Maybe that's the real religion that we should be talking about. That's all the time we have got here today on Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. You can visit me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Follow me on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. Have a great day, and God bless. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.